Clinic, session number 31509, rule 13.
Anyway, and I was back in India to pick up my stuff that I had left with the regimental depot, lots of uniforms and household chattels, and they were still with the regiment. We British officers had been told that we would no longer, the Pakistan Army no longer wanted us to stay. The longest anybody would stay, our services would be certainly, we were given the choice of going back for a short time, anything from 1 to 3 years at the most, or we could take the terms at the time when India and Pakistan got independence, and either resign our commissions or transfer to a British regiment. Well, I had been in the Air Force for so long that I wanted to go back to my regiment, if only to pick up my kit. And I stayed with the regiment for about 6 months in Ojra camp, or even less than that, perhaps 4 months, because I think I joined them about October, and I was on my way home again in around about February of the following year. Whilst I was at Ojra camp, I was having to decide what I was going to do. Was I going to go to British service or not? I had been invited by Hugh Lee, who was commanding the Carbineers, British cavalry, to go to his regiment. He said, "We'd like to have you, Gavin, if you decide to go to British service." And I felt that was a great honor. The Carbineers are an extremely good regiment. But I decided against it, because peacetime promotion in the army was very slow. I had got married young, which I wouldn't have been allowed to do because there was war on, and I had 2 sons, and I wouldn't be able to live in a cavalry regiment in England with a wife and 2 sons on my pay. I didn't have enough private means to make up the difference. So I decided that I could not go into British service. If I had plenty of money, I probably would have done. I had to find something else to do. At about that time, I read an article in the Morning Post, which later ceased to exist, but I think amalgamated with the Daily Telegraph, and it had banner headlines which stated, "Clive Street still wants you." Clive Street was the main business area, rather like Leadenhall Street in London, in Calcutta. And there were a lot of British businesses still in India that looked like staying on there for, well, who knew for how long, maybe forever. And as I had been in India already now for 13 years, I thought, if I could get a job in one of these big business houses in Calcutta, that'll be fine, well paid, go on living in the country where I knew the people and where they knew me, so the languages which I spoke. It seemed to be the right thing to do. So whilst I was in Pakistan, I thought, now how am I going to get to Calcutta from Pakistan? I can't go by surface route. And luckily, I met the ADC, to General Masservi, who was in command of the Pakistan Army at that time for a short period before the handover. And he was having to meet or visit units in East Pakistan. Now, at the beginning, there were 2 Pakistan. There was East Pakistan and West Pakistan. And, of course, East Pakistan was over 1,000 miles away to the east in Bengal. And sooner or later, they parted from West Pakistan. But at this time, they were together. And Masservi had to go and visit the troops in East Pakistan. And he was flying over in his private Dakota. And Wainwright, one of his ADCs, said, "Gavin, we've got plenty of seats. We can give you a lift to Calcutta and drop you off at Dum Dum, and we'll be coming back. We'll pick you up and bring you back again." So this was manna from heaven. I said, "Oh, thank goodness, thank you so much." Well, I had about a week in Calcutta, and I went around to all the big business houses. I won't name them all, but Barmer Lorry and McKinnon McKenzie's were amongst them. And McKinnon McKenzie was a part of the Inchcape Group, who was a shipping company who ran the P&O, and the BI Steamship Company, one of the biggest shipping companies in the world at that time. And I got a job with them. And they said, when can you join us? And I said, well, I'll have to get my release from the Army now, but I can probably join you in about a month or two's time at the most. And they said, that's fine. You will hear from us, and we will post you to one of our different places. And I went back, and I was told to join McKinnon & McKenzie in Bombay, in their Bombay office, which is a very civilized, very modern city. And I was absolutely delighted to have a job at a very stable organization. I mean, they were one of the big business houses out east. And I got a good job as with them. At first, I was in the accounts department to learn something of the ramifications of the business, but then I was put into a department which there were many departments to do with clearing and forwarding of baggage, and the shipping line departments, to which I actually went, into the Persian Gulf Line shipping department, in which I became the departmental head. And in due course, I took on the editorship of the BI News, which was put out three or four times a year. And
could I ask you about the journey you made when you went to find your job?
Oh, yes,
did you see anything about...
We certainly did. Maservi wanted to fly along the railway line where all these atrocities had taken place and see for himself at a low altitude what it looked like. And as we flew over this line, looked out of the windows of the aircraft, we went down quite low, not to... we went down quite low to about 1,000 feet and flew along, and we saw overturned trains that had been set on fire on the side of the track. We saw bodies lying around that hadn't been cleared away. There were vultures and crows and things everywhere. We were flying at 150 miles an hour, which is the normal cruising speed of a Dakota, and of course we didn't circle or look at anything, but we saw the carnage on the railway line between Delhi and Lahore, which was practically on the frontier of India-Pakistan, the new frontier of India-Pakistan. Lahore was just in Pakistan, inside Pakistan. Just the other side of the line was Amritsar, some few miles to the east of Lahore. That was in India. In between Amritsar, which was the headquarters of the Sikh nation, and Lahore, which was an old Mughal capital, or semi-capital, and was now the Pakistan capital, in that short line of 30-odd miles, we saw all this detritus from the murdering that had gone on. We didn't actually see any taking place, Robert. It was just the aftermath. I would like to mention one thing. One of my brother officers, well, in fact, he was in the Guides Cavalry, the 10th Guides, the 11th PAVO, and the 12th Sam Brown Cavalry were in the same group. Douglas Reed was his name. He was the same seniority as me. He had been at Sandhurst with me in my company, and I knew him well. He was one of those unfortunates who, with his regiment, without his regiment, I beg your pardon, he was going separately to rejoin his regiment in Pakistan, and he had his Pathan orderly with him, and his train was one of those that was attacked. It was stopped, of course. They'd blocked the line. They couldn't go ahead, they couldn't race ahead. And the crowd came looking for Muslims. They were Sikhs and Hindus, of course. And they came to his carriage and they demanded he open his door. They had heard that he had his servant with him and that he was a Muslim. And he refused to do so. They said, Saab, we don't have any quarrel with you, but we want your Muslim orderly, and I'm afraid if you do not let him go, we will have to kill you too. Well, he opened the door of his carriage, and he had his revolver, and he took a few pot shots at them, and they shot him. And of course, they shot the Bataan orderly as well. That was, to me, a personal side of things. I'd known Dougie Reed for a long time, and it was disgraceful. The other thing, of course, was an awfully nice chap who was at Sandhurst with me in my company. He was the second tallest cadet. He was well over 6 foot, around about 6 foot four, 6 foot five. His name was Douglas Dykes, and he was in Baramulla at the time when the tribesmen tried to run into Kashmir and kill the Hindus and prevent the Hindu army, the Indian army, from getting in. But they stopped to loot, and as they would do, being the sort of people they were, on the way, and of course they were ineffective. In the looting, they came across this hospital up in the mountains on the edge of Kashmir, and they killed all the nurses in it and the doctors. They killed Douglas Dyke's wife, who was pregnant and in the hospital, and his small children who were with him, and of course they murdered him. Those were two things that affected me quite a lot of the time, the bestiality that went on, killing pointlessly people who had no quarrel against them.
Would they have been considered exceptional, you know, the fact that foreigners were...
They were in the wrong place at the wrong time. Yes.
Otherwise, did you feel safe walking about in the various... when you were in Delhi and...
Yes, I never felt... Yes. Never felt threatened. Not as threatened as when I was in Burma. It was relatively peaceful. But, I mean, I'm not an overly brave person in that respect. No, I didn't feel threatened. I thought, if I am threatened, I'll have to deal with it when that comes along, the best I can. And
your wife and children, they were safe, were they? Your wife and children?
My wife and children were actually at the time in England. So they were quite safe.
Yes, I was going to ask you about your time in the UK, you know, when you had to go back before all this happened. It would be interesting getting your impression, because you returned to austerity, Britain, didn't
Absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. I mean, everything was still rationed in 46, early 47, when I arrived home in March. My troop ship that repatriated me, I forget the name now, took me to Liverpool, and I had to get to Guernsey. I had to get down to Essex, where my wife and family were living at that time. So I took the train down, troop train, of course, to London. I'm trying to think where we'd have gone to. Probably we'd have gone to King's Cross from Liverpool. Anyway, I had with me my baggage. This is rather interesting. I'll prepare my earlier remarks with me, with my name on it. Brand new baggage. Everything I bring me out of Pakistan, I was taking back to England, and we were told by the officer in charge of troops on the train, you don't need to worry about your baggage. You're in England now, you'll be quite safe in the goods wagon and blah blah blah, and pick it up when you get to the station and get taxis and go up to where you're going. Well, that was fine. We got I suppose, King's Cross, and looking for my baggage in the goods in the baggage part of the train, I couldn't find it straight away. And I happened to see a taxi in one of the taxi lanes alongside the platform, and I spotted my brand new light suitcase with my initials in blue letters, packed in there with a lot of other suitcases. And I shouted, "Hey! What are you doing? You've got my suitcase there." Well, the taxi driver stopped. I made a lot of noise. And there were two smarmy-looking officers in the back, who are obviously not officers. They'd hired or stolen officers' equipment. And they were the Gunder element of London. They were there too, and they were robbing trains. People were coming back, troop ships. They'd brought things at Gibraltar to bring back to their families. That taxi was full of other people's suitcases. I got my suitcase off, and it was only after I had done that I thought, my gosh, those weren't genuine officers, and those weren't their suitcases. And I wish I'd realized that quick enough, but the taxi drove off, and they got away with it. But this was happening the whole time, because my father-in-law and his wife were at Waterloo Station. Her husband wanted to wander off and look around a bit, and they had one of these four-wheel trolleys with all their baggage on this trolley. And he said to his wife, "Please keep an eye on this." There was a restaurant there with a big window, and she went and sat inside and started talking after a bit to a woman who was in there. And she was talking away. The trolley was there with her baggage when she started talking. And her husband came back and said, "Where's the trolley?" It had gone. Everything that they had brought back from India with them, everything had gone. That was London and the nice people who were living in London and preying on returning troop ships and people. No worse, no better than the Gunders in Delhi, stealing from their own like, who had little pavement shops and taking everything they could. I'm afraid they're still there, and still in this country. And they are. I'm not talking about immigrants now, who will come in without anything. I'm talking about actual inhabitants of this country, who, to me, are lower than scum.
So in England,
I mean, they profit from a situation. They're there. They come out of the woodwork.
Yes, I expect England was a very different place to return.
Ah, yes. Well, of course, there was this rationing, very strict rationing. I was given my ration cards, just like everybody else. And if I wanted to buy a new pair of corduroy trousers, the sort of things you could buy in those days on your cards. They were not proper corduroy, of course. They were cotton corduroy, not velvet. But I had plenty of clothes, fortunately, because I had been out east all the time. So I wasn't very much affected. We lived in the country. We had a house. We had a garden. We had vegetables. We grew our own vegetables. My wife did. We had a gardener who, of course, was the major key person in that business. And we were in a very much of a country area in North Essex. And so, apart from things like meat and sausages and that, which were rationed when you went to the butcher shop, I don't remember feeling any privation from not.
What did you think of the cities, going through the cities, you know, that the devastation? Were you impressed by that in any way, London, Liverpool?
Well, the only cities I saw any damage, and of course I saw a lot, was in London, especially the dock area and in the city area. Whole areas were laid flat. Talking about rationing, I had a very wealthy Indian friend who happened to be the representative for Hyderabad in London at the time. And he invited my wife and I out to lunch with him in London to a very famous, very well-known restaurant. And we were given food which you could not buy. it was, I didn't pay the bill. I have no idea what it cost. The highly bad government probably was paying for his bill and my bill, but we were his guests. We could have anything we wanted that you could get in peacetime. Obviously, it was all black market stuff. Come over from France, there was foie gras, there was meats and fishes and vegetables and fruit and luxury items of food that you only would buy normally before the war in London in peacetime. They were all, it was all there in that restaurant, in that restaurant, I'm sorry. I don't know if I should mention the restaurant's name, I don't think it matters very, very much now, but it was called the Elephant Blanc, the white elephant. And it was full. There were a lot of war profiteers, only sort of people who had a lot of money could afford to go to places like that, and people in political departments. But for everybody else, it was tough. But people were healthy, much healthier then than they are now.
Yes, the rations were minimal but nutritious, weren't they?
Yes, they were. Yes, they were. But people weren't making pigs of themselves. They couldn't. And they were much healthier as a result.
Did you have any contact with the Air Force at all in London? I was thinking you would have.
Yes, I was given. I went home with the RAF.
Yes.
They still considered me in the RAF. At the end of my month's leave, I waited for my posting orders, and I found I was going to be posted to the Air Ministry.
Did you go to Duxford at all while you were in?
I did. I went to Duxford, but that was it.
Just a visit.
Yes. I was hoping to get converted onto Meteors, and to, with luck, get another squadron. I didn't want to go back to being a flight commander, but this was almost inevitable because wing commanders and group captains were coming, dropping one or two ranks to what their peacetime ranks would have been, and dropping pay as well. And the Air Force was only keeping the people that they wanted, that they considered the best. If you were not the best, they say, very sorry, nice knowing you, thank you for all you've done, and you've got your bowler hat. When told that I was probably going to be temporarily transferred, posted to the MSU, I said, I didn't fly, I didn't join the Air Force to fly a desk. I remember making that remark. And they said, what do you mean? And I said, well, I seconded from my regiment in 17th November 1941, if you look it all up. And they said, well, you should have gone back at the end of hostilities. And well, of course, I was in Burma then, and I was being ordered to Penang, and then down to Singapore eventually, and then to the North West Front. It went on, it was years as I was still in the Air Force. I was very lucky. And my regiment was likely to go to India. I thought, well, I'll stay where I'm safe and have a proper job to do, which is why I didn't make any move. But see, I want to go back to the army or anything of that sort. I was in the Air Force. I was enjoying myself. I had a command, and it was a secure job. And until they didn't want me, I would stay with them. Of course, as I said, when this posting order came up for me, when I went up to London, was told I'd probably be posted to the ministry for temporary, because they were had to find jobs for all of us, and it was a question of a lot of squadrons had been disbanded. There weren't the number of squadrons around anymore to post you to. So whilst they were making up their minds where they were sending everybody to, this is what happened. I made my remark, and I find myself back in the army immediately. And the army, unfortunately, forgot to pay me for the first 2 months. It takes a long time for the control of the military accounts to like all financial things, they, to their own advantage, they work extremely slowly. And so the Air Force pay stopped immediately, and for 2 months I had no pay at all. I knew I'd be paid, I wasn't worried. But the thing is that that was the way it was. It was all part of the muddle after the war, and eventually it sorted itself out. I got my 2 months back pay, and and was sent out to India, and then decided that the Indian Army was not for me, as I've already gone into. And yeah.
You had your job in Calcutta?
I had my job in Calcutta.
Or Bombay, was it?
In Bombay, first.
In Bombay, yes.
Yes. Yeah. I was there for 3 years, which was a normal tour of duty in all these firms, and the banks and that. And then you would go home for about 6 months, leave, home leave, and then come back and take up again the job that you had. It was really like the army in some ways, that organization.
The British were still welcome in India, were they? The business people?
As far as the big cities were concerned, like Calcutta and Bombay, they controlled they held all the reins. Indians were, of course, trying to pick up everything, but the British firms were very strongly ensconced, and it took time for the Indians to catch up and supplement to say we don't want you anymore. And as far as McKinnon and McKenzie was concerned, they were so powerful, so wealthy, they stayed in India and for a good 10 years more. But we not only traded internationally with our ships, but we had to have a coastal license to operate around India. The Indian government was smart. They took away our coastal license, and then that made things very difficult. And we had to go back. We had to move the office from Calcutta eventually, go back to London, operate from Leadenhall Street, and then at that time, air was taking over from the sea. Shipping companies went into a decline. The P&O, which was part of the Inchcape Group, took to dealing with cruise liners, and they became part of Bovis, or Bovis became part of them. They moved into other fields and into cross-channel ferries and that sort of thing. They are still in existence in different ways, but by 1960, there were very few British-operated companies left in India. More, perhaps I should say between 60 and 70. Some stayed on because they took in Indian partners, kept their old names and that sort of thing.
Yes, and of course India's doing so well today, isn't it?
Oh, remarkably well, yes.
Yes, the people do seem to be very industrious, don't they? And
Yes.
Well, this is the end of Reel 12 and Reel 13. Gavin Douglas.